Okay, let us begin. I'm Robert Wade. I'm Professor of Political Economy here at LSE, and it's my privilege tonight to be simply chairing this session. The session is to hear Jeff Sachs present the core argument of his book, The End of Poverty, just hot off the press, and then for us, the panel, for us, the whole gathering, to discuss this book in a critical and academic and intellectual spirit. I'm going to first introduce Jeff. I will introduce the other two panelists before they speak. I'm going to apply to Jeff my law of introductions, which says that the more confident is the host that the speaker will say something interesting, the shorter the introduction. And therefore, it's necessary for me to say only a few points about Jeff. First of all, he is the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. Secondly, he is the advisor to Kofi Annan and the UN on this very controversial idea of the Millennium Development Goals. Thirdly, he is a professor of economics, and you will see from his presentation that his approach to the question of how to end poverty is heavily influenced by the worldview of neoclassical economics. That may be taken as a compliment or a criticism. The fourth point is that he, I have to know, is married to a very nice pediatrician, and that is actually quite relevant to his way of thinking about the problem of how to end mass poverty. And finally, as I just said, and most important for this occasion, he is the author of this book. So the game plan for the evening is that he will speak for half an hour, not a minute longer. We will then hear two comments from our discussants, whom I will introduce, and then it will be open to you to fire your hard-nosed questions, and we will finish by 8 o'clock. I should just say now that we have a collective action problem, which is that people have to leave at the end, but then other people will want to talk to Jeff. So the idea is that if you remain seated to solve this collective action problem, you remain seated and we leave, and then the mobbing of Jeff can take place outside where he will be signing copies of his book for those of you who buy them. So with that introduction, Jeff, the floor is yours.
Very much. It sounds a little like a wedding processional that we go out and then you come out to say hello to the bride. Thank you very much for being here. Robert, thank you for moderating. Mr. Ambassador, Richard Curtis, it's a great pleasure for me to be here, and especially in this hall. It's one of the places actually on the planet, I have to tell you, I love the most, this hall, because I've had the honor to speak from the stage a few times, and for me, very memorable times. And among the most memorable times were three lectures that I gave in 1991, when Poland was just coming out of communism, and the questions were whether there would be civil war, whether there would be chaos, or whether there would be a way to become a market economy, and most importantly, in my view, as I lectured on those days, whether Poland could return to Europe. And all I can say is just in the nick of time, they came into the European Union last year, so I could come back today and say I was right, you know. And that's always the most fun to say. So, and I was on that one, I think. I want to talk about something for the year 2025, and I do want a date to come back in 2026, and I hope we can all get together on that occasion. I think that if we're smart and determined, honorable, consequent, maybe already you think it's impossible, but if we are all the things, and most of all, if we follow through on things that we said we would do in the world at the start of this millennium and then in several occasions since then, I think we have an opportunity that is unique for us on the planet and very important. And I have a feeling, this being LSE and this being the kind of group that it is, that the people here will play an absolutely pivotal role if we're to have success. So it's very important for us to have this discussion tonight. The proposition is that we can end extreme poverty on the planet in our generation. And the sub-proposition is it won't happen without us, meaning it's not just the natural course of events. This actually, in my view, has very little to do with neoclassical economics. Just want to be clear, quite seriously, this has to do with a lot of collective action that is necessary to overcome some extraordinarily difficult but surmountable challenges. I believe in markets and I believe in globalization, and I don't believe that they are enough by any means to accomplish what we need to accomplish. I believed that market forces would be very powerful in helping Poland to return to Europe in an economic and political sense. But after all, Poland is on a long plane connected next door with the largest economy in Europe and with a good highway system and grid and communications and everything else. The places that I'm talking about that are not right now part of general progress, in fact, they're not only not part of general progress, but are not even on a path of development right now, but are suffering such extreme deprivation that people are dying by the millions every year, are not on the plains of Northern Europe, nor connected by rail and auto and power grids and communications. They are people that are, as I'll stress, in among the most difficult circumstances on the planet. They are disconnected from the world economy. It's not globalization that's killing them, but mosquitoes, AIDS, economic isolation, drought, and many other horrendous challenges that claim the lives of very poor people and block them from being part of the world economy. Neoclassical economics doesn't get it right. Anti-globalization doesn't get it right. But I think bed nets treated with insecticide and artemisinin combination therapies for controlling malaria could get it right. What we need is a proper diagnosis, a proper investment, and a spirit of cooperation that can address practical problems that keep poor people dying on the planet right now and leaving them no practical ways forward. And that's what I want to talk about. And I want you to meet some of the people that I am meeting every month, I would say, regularly, faces that stick in my mind and for reasons that you'll see very clearly. The book opens with a trip to a village outside of Lilongwe, Malawi, where we met this woman. And these are her grandchildren and a few other children in the village. And these are orphaned children. She's the grandmother. Her four children have died of AIDS. She's tending to orphaned grandchildren. They live in an adobe hut with the thatch that you see. They barely survive. The definition of extreme poverty, in my view, is poverty that kills. It means poverty so severe that you could die tomorrow. If you're unlucky with a virus, if the rains fail, if a pest hits the crops, if some other kind of instability comes, you're that close to the edge. And I think a reasonable estimate is that about 8 million people each year go over the edge, dying of poverty by any reasonable definition. They're, of course, dying of AIDS, they're dying of malaria, they're dying of TB, they're dying of respiratory infection, they're dying of diarrheal disease, they're dying of chronic undernourishment, which can kill you in 1,000 different ways. They're dying of poverty by any definition. That's the kind of community this is. When we visited it, we drove past fields of rotted and shrunken maize because this was a drought. 2002 in El Nino, 10,000 miles away in the Western Pacific, meant no rain in Malawi. It meant a failed harvest, as is happening right now, once again, in Malawi, where the maize is failing because the rains failed in February. These people were hungry. The woman showed us a handful of millet that was going to be the gruel for dinner that night. The children have a meal a day, maybe. They are undernourished. They are stunted. They're anemic. They're probably constantly parasitemic with falciparum plasmodium, in other words, malaria, but subclinical, and with geohelminths, with worms. And that's the life of hundreds of millions of people on the planet. One of the children had malaria the week before. The grandmother carried the girl on her back for 3 hours to get to the clinic. Another definition of extreme poverty. No primary health care anywhere nearby. You don't call the ambulance. You don't hop on the bus. You don't take the metro or the tube. You walk. If the child's alive when you get there, you find out, as this grandmother did, that there's no quinine that day. Come back the next day. Children like this all over Africa go into respiratory distress. They go into coma. They die. Perhaps 3 million children will die this year of malaria, a 100% treatable disease. 100% treatable. A course of effective medications right now for malaria is about $1.20 for a pediatric dose of artemisinin and combination drugs, coartemeter, produced by Novartis. 3 days, 3 pills, it costs about $1.20, and 3 million children will die. About 3 million children, because we don't take the time even to count. Drought, economic isolation, AIDS, holoendemic malaria, landlockedness, that's extreme poverty. Those are the challenges we need to understand. This was last month in a clinic in Western Kenya. The white thing in this child's mouth is a tongue depressor so that the child in cerebral malaria, in seizure, does not bite off his tongue. Child did make it to a quinine IV line, but who knows? I don't know whether this child survived or not. I don't know whether there's going to be a lifetime of complications having been in cerebral malaria, but the child was given sulfadoxine pyrimethamine, SP, which doesn't work anymore because of drug resistance. And the donors have not seen fit for many years now, knowing this, to help make a reasonable changeover to an effective new generation of medicines because they cost more money. And poor people self-prescribe drugs that don't work, and they die. This is the children's ward in that sub-district hospital the same day. The day we got there, 3 children to a bed. I want you to understand this. Kenya spends $7 per capita per year on health. We spend, in the United States, $6,000 per person per year on health. In the UK, it's about 2,500 would be my guess, per person per year. You may get better care than we get at 6,000, actually. But I'll tell you, $7 per year doesn't buy you a lot of health care. It buys you first-class disaster. Why 7? Because this is an impoverished country. impoverished countries can't spend more money. This is what poverty means. It doesn't mean the Kenyans don't want health care. They can't afford health care. And I don't want to hear about the corruption of the health service and all the rest. It's nonsense. Read Lancet when looking at the pediatric services, and it said it exactly as I know it in Kenya, and I've been visiting these hospitals for years. The staff is incredibly motivated. The staff works round the clock. The nurses see 70 patients on the ward. You know what it's like to have an 8-hour shift with 70 patients and you're the only nurse on the ward? It's impossible, is what it is. Every time I leave the clinic, someone grabs me and says, bring another nurse. I go to the donors for 2 years, help them hire nurses. So far, no result. That's the adult ward that same day, just last month. It was a light day, only two to a bed. You go in with malaria and you're put in a bed with someone with tuberculosis. This is called semi-private. Sharing a bed in a hospital, I had never even imagined it, which is my first advice to students of development. You'll never see it in the textbooks. Go have a look with your own eyes. If you want to do development, go do development. Go see it. The textbooks won't tell you. Two to a bed, head to foot. This is like this all over Africa right now. You have the largest pandemic in modern history, AIDS, resurgent malaria because of drug resistance, tuberculosis coming on the back of AIDS, and children in there with acute lower respiratory infection, with diarrheal disease because of lack of safe drinking water, and on and on. The women we meet in these areas, 5-6 hours a day collecting water. That's the life. When you turn on the tap tonight, that's a 2-hour job of backbreaking work, walking to a water hole for unsafe water and walking back with 20 kilos on your shoulders or on your head. Do it 3 times a day. That's life. Raise children, take care of your sick children, cook the meal, mill the grain, get the water. Then we hear they don't work hard enough. You hear, well, in the tropics, you just pick the fruit. You know, what's the incentive? How much disastrous nonsense has been said on the planet about people who work literally to death? That's dinner time. That's a good picture of a horrendous situation. It's a woman sitting in a smoke-filled room after cooking with a wood stove. And this is what kills probably more than 1 million children a year of acute lower respiratory infection, because the particulates from this kind of wood burning, which is absolutely traditional, the point here is there's no chimney. That's the point. So the particulates are all through the house. The abrasion of the lungs is so severe that you get pneumonia and the children die. And then this was Mr. Ambassador, in your country just 2 weeks ago. This is in the village of Kararo in Tigray province in Ethiopia. And it was a sight that I had not imagined. I'll tell you in a moment about this most wondrous visit that we had. But this was a sight that absolutely shocked me, and clearly you see a lot that can shock you. This is a sight of men digging for water in the middle of the riverbed. I'd never seen it before. This is the perennial river of this group of villages, 11,000 people along this riverbed, but the river has run dry. The last 5 years, the short rains, the Belg rains, have failed. So the water crisis is to a point of fighting for survival. So we were taken out to an absolutely dry riverbed described as the perennial river. And the men are digging a hole because they've been able to get a generator, and they're going to try to pump some water up to save some crops. This is the very edge of survival. This is poverty that kills. What do we do about this right now on the planet? I think if you had to say one sentence summary, it's we send the IMF. And the recommendation is tighten your belts. And if you look closely, they don't have belts. There's nothing to tighten. They have nothing. These are non-monetized economies. The World Bank said to privatize the fertilizer peristatals. That'll solve the problem. These people don't have money to buy fertilizer. And what was the traditional mode of keeping soil nutrients replenished, which was rotating the farm through a large area, because in 20 years the nitrogen is naturally refixed in this environment. The atmospheric nitrogen becomes reactive nitrogen through lightning and through nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Now there is no rotation of crops because population densities have risen so much. Every year you farm the same land. If you farm, take out the crops, take out the nutrients, and don't put anything back, you biophysically reach a point sooner rather than later when you can't produce a crop that can feed you. That's a poverty trap. That's what they're in. Even in a good rainy year, they're producing 1 ton of maize or 1 ton of teff per hectare. And that's not enough even for the farmer to feed the family, much less to bring goods to market. These people are trapped in poverty. They're trapped because, if we think about it, not because they're being exploited by multinational companies. That's actually not the reason. I looked far and wide, couldn't find a multinational company there either. No belts, no multinational companies. These people are left alone to die right now. Why? I think broadly speaking, no, let's not speak broadly first. Let's go back to a very important word. That's the one I learned from my wife, clinical pediatrician. Diagnose. Don't think there's one answer. The family calls with a fever. It could be 50 things, could be 100 things. I'm so damn jealous of the doctors. Our medical, economic, pathophysiology book has one word in it these days. It says corruption. That's the explanation of everything. Or exploitation. That's another different volume. But actually, my wife's textbook has about 50 chapters and about 1,500 pages. And if you try to diagnose a fever, you go through a long differential diagnosis. We need to do that wherever we work.
Here's what I think is really going on. No, I've lost that.
See if the wire is connected.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
good. Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. I'm going to talk loud. What's the essence of those villages? At least three things. Massive disease burden, chronic hunger because of low food productivity, and economic isolation. When I think about that, and think about the difference of Asia and Africa in the last 40 years, when Asia was impoverished, India to many hopeless, constantly famine-ridden, and ask what happened in the last 45 years, I would start with the following propositions. First, Asia had a green revolution. Asia had a massive increase in food production per hectare. Africa did not. Why? Because the combination of technologies that made the green revolution were high-yield variety seeds, fertilizer, and irrigation. to me, this is the starting point of Asia's takeoff from extreme poverty and chronic famine. What's the difference of Africa and Asia? The Himalayas, clearly. The Himalayas mean the Indus, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, the Yangtze. It means vast, fertilized river valleys where hundreds of millions of people live, and which became the breadbasket of Asia because these vast floodplains are irrigated, high water table, and you could put in the Green Revolution technologies. In Africa, 96% of the staple production is rain-fed. Most of Africa lives in the savanna, and the savanna in its wet seasons is irregular. There's vulnerability to drought, and it's extremely hard. You couldn't use that package of technologies in rain-fed agriculture. There was no Green Revolution. Second, the endemicity of disease, tropical disease, completely different. Africa has by far the highest malaria burden in the world and always has since malaria first passed from animal to humans probably about 7,000 years ago, according to the genetic clock. Why Africa? It's hot and they have really nasty mosquitoes. Africa's Anopheles mosquitoes are Gambi, and they love to bite people. India's, for example, the dominant species is Culicifaces. They like to bite cattle. It's very convenient. It breaks the human-to-human transmission. It leads to about one-tenth the burden of malaria in India, as in West Africa, for example. This is extraordinarily important. It's bad luck. It's not evil. It's not corruption. It is a high vectorial competence, as the epidemiologists would say. And third, about 80% of Africans live in the interior of the continent. They're more landlocked countries, people living farther away from the coasts than in any other part of the world. It seems odd at first glance, except it's in the highlands of Ethiopia, in the highlands of East Africa, where the rainfall is more plentiful. That's called orographic uplift. The east trade winds come over the highlands of East Africa and drop rain on the highlands. If you live on the coast in Somaliland, in Ethiopia or in Somalia, or what's left of it, it's completely desert. So you live in the interior. Try to get a foreign investor to come in 1,000 miles into the interior of Africa to produce shirts for export. If you do it, let me know how, because no one else has figured out how to do it. And so foreign investment, other than for diamonds, gold, oil, gas, some copper, you don't get it. And this is a major challenge as well. What this is an overlay of these three indexes of disease, food growing potential, and distance from coast. And the dark shaded areas of Africa clearly are the ones with the highest index of vulnerability. The point I'm making is that there's some background here to the extreme poverty trap, to the inability to have made a transition easily to high food production, to effective manufacturing export base, and to disease control.
Jeff.
Yes, 5 minutes. I told you all of that. Don't worry. What do you need to do? You need to do clinical economics. You need to say, okay, I got a diagnosis, what to do? First thing to do, talk to people. Talk to the people in the places, not in the finance ministries, not at the Hilton. Go to the villages, that's where 3/4 of the people live in extreme poverty. And they're happy to come, as they did in this meeting in Western Kenya, or as they did, Mr. Ambassador, in this meeting in Cararo. You may recognize the scene. Prime Minister Melis gave a famous wartime talk as the troops were moving to Addis to overthrow the Mengistu regime, and they met here in the caves in these rocks. And there I am with a colleague of mine, and we had a couple thousand people that came a couple of weeks ago to have an open-air, many-hour discussion of the practical problems. Boy, they know the answers. They don't need a lot of lectures, but they do need some technology, and they know that. They're aware that they're not using fertilizers. They're aware they're not using improved seeds. They're aware that they're cut off from the outside. This isn't a situation of lack of awareness. This is a situation where people are extremely poor, and they know it. And by the way, when we got to this village, the first thing they handed us was the organogram of the governance structure of the village, organized in committees, village council, linked to the district office. These are normal people. They happen to be poor. That's all. It's very important, because in the United States, we think that these people are out to rip us off, that their highest aspiration in life is to steal our aid. That's what we spend all our time worrying about. How are they going to steal our aid? Because they're corrupt. Because that must be why they're poor, after all. That's the logical trap that we're in. We blame them for the problems. Then since we blame them, we assume that they're nefarious. And boy, are they shifty. They can't wait to get their hands on that malaria bed net to sell it in the black market and put that $5 into a Swiss bank account. Every one of them told me that. It's amazing. Some of them are going to stick the net itself right into the safe deposit box. What do you do? Something simple as a water hole with a tarp underneath it. You have to pay for the tarp. They can't afford the tarp. You do that, you have water available for the seedlings during the dry season so you can plant tree crops during the rainy season. And there I am on my first expedition on a treadle pump. $80, as long as the water table's within 10 meters, you can irrigate the field. They cannot afford an $80 treadle pump. But it works just fine. This woman is a master farmer in Western Kenya. This is crotalaria, which is a leguminous, meaning nitrogen-fixing tree. It's a coppicing tree. You can cut the plant. The leaves are filled with nitrogen. They give 100 kilo per hectare. That's what you would put on with diammonium phosphate. You replenish the nitrogen, and the result is you get a full maize crop at 3 tons per hectare rather than 1 ton per hectare. You need agricultural extension and some capital for the seeds. They can't afford. You also need to put in some potassium in some places or phosphorus in other places, which is not naturally fixed. But if you do that, you can lift yields in Africa by about 3 times, from 1 ton to 3 tons, in the mixed maize regions of the country. This is something as simple, obviously, as it's a rock bund or a check dam to stop water rushing down the hills and taking the topsoil away. What do you need for this? You need a little bit of mesh so that the stones aren't overthrown by the water coming down. So the village asked us, we'll put up the stones. They've been up in the hills. Now these villagers for the last month preparing for the rainy season. And they asked us for some mesh, which we've given them, because that's what's going to keep these little check dams in place. Feed children at school meals. It is the most successful single proven intervention. So help the farmers grow more food. Use a part of it to feed children. The children go to school and they learn. They get a full, proper, nutritious meal, and this has been shown time and again. And I come to country after country, and the World Food Program officer tells me about the school meals program. I say, how's it going? They say, it's wonderful. Attendance has gone up to 100%. The girls are in school. The children are learning better. So what are you doing? Well, we're doing it in that district. Why aren't you doing it all over the country? Oh, because the donors have funded one district. That's ground reality. These are women dipping the bed net for fighting malaria in insecticide. Now there are nets, I just didn't have a picture of it, that last 5 years without retreatment. They cost $5. I've been to village after village. The people cannot afford a $5 outlay even when it lasts 5 years and two of their children sleep under it, 50 cents per child. And this, as shown by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, just down the block, repeatedly, can reduce all-cause mortality of children by 40% when combined with effective interventions in community health. And this is what we ought to be doing over the endemic and epidemic regions of Africa. The cost is tiny. I've got it confirmed. I've been saying that it's one cup of coffee for each of us per year because I was assuming that it's a $3 cup. Today, there was actually an article in the newspaper that said how much a cup of coffee costs in London. It's $3.11 on average. And that means that we even have some, if everybody would give one cup of coffee per year, we'd have a little spare change because we only need $3 billion a year from the rich world. There are a billion of us. One cup of coffee per person per year. You'd buy bed nets and artemisinin and combination therapies, local diagnostics, and training of community health workers. Here, and I'm 2 minutes? No problem. Here is something very simple. This is opening the first boxes of antiretroviral combination therapies coming to this clinic in Western Kenya. This is fixed dose combinations. One pill in the morning, one pill at night, $130 a year for a treatment course for an individual now. Less than 30 cents a day. No, 30 cents a day. And the result is you could keep millions of people alive that are going to die this year because they don't have this. For 3 years, I've been going to this clinic and seeing people dying because they didn't have a 30 cent a day dose of medicine. It finally started arriving last month. And finally, not quite finally, second from finally, the villagers said, can you give us some cement and some wiring and a corrugated roof? We want to build a clinic. You provide a doctor, which was what we said we would do for the village. They said, we'll build a clinic. In 5 weeks, the community put up a proper clinic with their own labor, with the whole community getting involved. They bought the bricks, they did the labor, they did the groundwork, the district ministry of health built it, and this is midway through what is now a full standing clinic in Western Kenya. And finally, I just wanted to show you the community health workers. In one of the most moving and touching moments recently in this village, we got together with the community health workers who are volunteer workers in the villages in this area, and we asked them, what do you want to be effective? And the answer could have been, we want 3-4-wheel drives, and we want a proper salary and all the rest. And the answer was, we'd like you to train us to understand better AIDS, malaria, and the other diseases we're facing because we haven't had training in many, many years. And that's going on right now. What's the upshot of this? The upshot of this is that the people that are sick and dying in the world are sick and dying not because of the state-owned fertilizer company, but because of malaria or AIDS or lack of safe water or lack of water for or instruments for micro-irrigation. There are practical problems that very poor people face. The most practical problem is because they're impoverished, they can't make even the most basic investments to get out of the trap. If we diagnose properly and stop blaming the poor for the extraordinary life-taking crisis that they're in, all of these challenges have practical solutions. You can pave roads, cell phones work in these villages, trucks do just fine in helping these remote areas to reach markets. Food output can go up dramatically. Lives can be saved. They can't afford it. The bottom line, and we'll come back in discussion, is that it depends on us. We have promised 70 cents of $100 of our GNP for the last 35 years in aid. We have failed to deliver all but 5 countries. Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, and Luxembourg have fulfilled the commitment. 7 more recently have promised. UK, fortunately, with great leadership this year and a wonderful Africa Commission report. France, Belgium, Spain, Ireland, and Finland have all set a timetable now to reach 0.7. And last week, Germany joined the list. We're seeing, finally, the kind of movement that can make a difference. There's one major country that you noticed wasn't on the list. Fortunately, he's best buddies with Tony. And Tony has to say to his friend George, George, you're spending $500 billion this year on the military and a miserable $16 billion on development. And millions are dying. And your country has turned their back on them. And this is not making the world safe. Come along with us. Come to Glen Eagles. Bring your checkbook. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. You can see from that the remarkable synergy, and you can imagine the dinner table conversation between Jeff's argument about the causes of mass poverty and the way to end mass poverty and the expertise of his pediatrician wife. A figure on the background, by the way, to aid between 1990 and 2000, the percentage of GNP spent on aid in the OECD on average fell by 50%. That's the background to what Jeff has just been talking about. Now we have two discussants. The first one is the Ethiopian ambassador to London, His Excellency Fisahe Adunya. And what you have to know about him is that he is a senior member of the Ethiopian diplomatic service. He has spent quite a few years in Washington and quite a few years in London. And it's particularly appropriate that he be a commentator on this argument and on this book, because so much of what Jeff was talking about was illustrated by the case of Ethiopia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, you might feel as miserable as one could be to become the next speaker after Professor Jeffrey Sachs. With this eloquent speech, we should have said amen and leave the room. But, you know, since I'm part of the program, I have to say something. You know, it is just like somebody is telling you to compete Haile Gebrselassie, that, you know, your chance of winning is practically zero. I'm sure you must have heard Haile Gebrselassie, arguably the best athlete in history. But anyway, I will try. First of all, let me express my sincere thanks to the event organizers for inviting me to be part of this important occasion. I would like to convey my profound congratulations to Professor Jeffrey Sachs for honoring us with his excellent book, The End of Poverty. As you all know, Professor Sachs is a pioneer in fighting poverty, and his latest contribution is not something that came about by accident. He is always there fighting for equality and justice, empowering those who were left behind, showing the world how extreme poverty can be eliminated. He's obviously a great friend of Ethiopia. Is a great friend of Africa. The end of poverty is a very serious work. It is a tremendous achievement. It is an achievement of historic proportion. When poverty becomes history, I hope sooner than later. One of those serious work, Professor Sachs' book will be remembered as one of those serious work that contributed to the elimination of extreme poverty. We in Ethiopia know poverty. We went through it. And in the last 10 years, we are so determined to change that trend. When we say we are so determined to change, we came up with a very comprehensive program, which is called Poverty Reduction Program. That program is in full implementation phase now. I'm not going to lecture about what Ethiopia has done in all those areas, because poverty is a big problem, and of course, a big solution is needed. But I wanted to cite what Ethiopia has done in education. In Ethiopia, we believe education is the key to eliminate poverty, abject poverty in our country. In 1994, Ethiopia has an enrollment rate of 27% to schools, which means out of 100 kids that are eligible to go to school, it's only 27% that were permitted to go to school. But now, after 10 days, we are very much proud we brought this figure to 73%. It's a very tremendous achievement by all standards. We have 10 million elementary students in the country now. Ethiopia, I don't know how many of you know the population of Ethiopia, it's 71 million now. Out of that, 10 million kids are going to school now. It is not by chance, it is not by accident that happened. The Ethiopian government decided to put 23% of the total budget to education, changing the trend that used to go to the military, now shifted to the education. And it is not only elementary school. Obviously, we built thousands and thousands of elementary schools everywhere throughout the country. It is not in a place where we could not build a formal classroom with blackboard, chairs, desk, and so forth. There are schools under trees. There are mobile schools with the nomads in Ethiopia. But we believe that education is the key to reduce poverty in our country. We have so many teacher training in the country, and Ethiopia produces more than 20,000 teachers per year now. And of course, in 1994, we had only one university in the country. The population of Ethiopia was at that time about 50 million. For 50 million population, we just had one university with the intake of 3,000 students per year. But now, we have 8 universities with the intake capacity more than 32,000 in the country. We didn't have even one private college in the country. Now we have hundreds of them with the intake totally about 27,000. If you combine both of them, the public and the private one, Ethiopia has the enrollment rate for university education now in the territory of 60,000 as against 3,000. I know this story was not heard here because good stories are no news anymore in this city. We are trying to change that trend now because where do we bring this money? Of course, if debt is canceled for Ethiopia, Ethiopia will be in a position to build more schools, more clinics, and so forth. If development assistance increases in the country, of course, the money that comes will help Ethiopia to overcome the poverty, especially the health crisis in the country, and so forth. And market has, there must be an access of market to Ethiopia, of course. Professor Sachs was talking about the price of coffee. Ethiopia is the largest coffee exporter in Africa, but about 50 million Ethiopians are living on the income that comes from coffee. You know, 1 pound of coffee for a farmer is about 69 US cents. But you know, that 1 pound of coffee will produce about 20 cups of coffee in London, which will be about $70 here to the consumers at the end of the day. Coffee totally produce about $70 billion per year. But the share of coffee producers, countries, about 60 of us, is only less than 5 billion. You will see injustice there. There must be a level playing field for for developing countries, there must be an access. There must be a rule for the same for everybody. But you know, the tariffs and the subsidies cannot allow us to compete in a fair situation. Of course, we believe poverty can be eliminated. It can be eliminated because there is a conducive atmosphere in developing countries, in Africa especially now, that poverty can be eliminated. As you are well aware, there are so many countries which are going under a democratic change in the continent. About 34 countries have gone through some kind of elections. That will create a conducive atmosphere on the ground for poverty to be eliminated. It will be eliminated not because the rich are showing willingness to help, but the people in developing countries are determined to take the lead in fighting poverty. This is very crucial to reaching our goal. This year of 2005 is very exciting on many counts, as you are aware. The long struggle to tackle poverty has now gathered momentum. The world community vowed to achieve the ambitious objective of cutting poverty by half by the year 2015, and Professor Sachs is at the forefront in this. He has, of course, a very powerful argument in his book, How to Achieve That Goal. The Commission for Africa, on the other hand, has come up with the roadmap to achieve that goal in Africa, as I hope all of you are aware. The old approach didn't work. The donor-recipient relationship did not yield fruit. Structural adjustment proved disastrous. A new imaginative, fresh, and progressive approach was needed. That is how a genuine partnership between the developed and the developing countries has to emerge. Africa is ready to make this partnership work and work effectively. Democratic changes are sweeping across the continent, as I said. More accountable, more transparent, and more democratic regimes are emerging. Elections have become the norm in many countries. My own country, ruled by monarchs for centuries and lately by military dictators, finally embraced democracy, and the third multi-party elections will be conducted on May 15th. We are looking forward to Gleneagle, to the summit of the most powerful leaders, to them finally putting their print on the partnership laid by the report on the Commission of Africa and the principles that were laid by Professor Sachs, demonstrating their political will that poverty is not only a problem of poor nations, it is an affront to humanity, whether moral or in pursuit of one's conscious interest. Poverty is evil, and it has to be tackled like slavery and colonialism, to borrow Nelson Mandela's recent speech. The public in Europe and North America are gearing up to make poverty history. The people in the developing world are ready to do their share. This coalition has gathered momentum. Professor Sachs has shown the way forward. Let's be part of this historical moment. It offers a win-win situation for everybody. I thank you.
Investing in primary education and investing in agricultural productivity increases. That one we can perhaps leave till later. But our next discussant is Richard Curtis, the film and television writer. He is a co-founder of Comic Relief and a leading member of the 2005 Make Poverty History campaign. Richard.
I'm very keen indeed that you should have as much time to ask Jeff questions as you can. So I'd just like to say three very quick things. One, this is a really, really good book. It's the first serious book I've ever read, and I've read it. I've read it twice, and I wrote the film of Bridget Jones, and I haven't even finished that book. So it's really, really unusual for me to get through anything like this. And, I mean, I can't, you'd be mad not to buy it and give it to people at Christmas. I mean, it's just full of the most extraordinary things. I don't know what you guys do here, but Jeff, Jeff deals with the whole of economic history in 18 pages. So you could take 2.5 years off if that's what you're, if that's what you're studying. And he does. They're fantastic biographical sections about places where he's worked, and he gives you this amazing feeling that we are living in history, that it isn't an inevitable thing, that things are actually sort of changing around us and happening, and the things that we think have been here forever have actually only been here for 20 or 30 or 40 years. So I mean, you won't get all the funny misprints I've got in my copy, but it is really a great book, and I recommend that you buy it and get him to sign it, because I think that it might be one of the great books of this century. Someone said this great thing to me, that nobody knew in 1900 what were the big books, and they were already there. Marx was writing away, and Freud, much to my cost, was writing away. And I think this may turn out to have been one of the important ones. So that's my main message. The second thing I just want to say, which is just for me to say in a way as part of Comic Relief, which is a television show, and as someone who works in this area, is that I think there's another whole issue about communication and media on the issue of poverty, which I think is terrifically important. I've been talking recently to people in America trying to sort of understand why the pitch of their campaigning is less than it is here and depends upon an Irishman. And of course, Bob Geldof's Irish too, so what are we to talk in England? But I think that it's extraordinary. When I was talking to people from the Gates Foundation the other day, they said that their university-educated friends of the same age, when they talked about what they were doing with Bill Gates, said, I can't understand why you would be spending your time working on poverty in Africa when there's so much poverty in the USA. And these are intelligent, educated people. And I think that there's a sort of history of talking about these issues in the UK, you know, through Oxfam and Save the Children, but now through what Bob did on Live Aid, through what we've done a little bit on Comic Relief, and through particularly, you know, documentaries here in the UK, which has an unbelievable historic importance, because if people don't have any idea that life is different elsewhere, then they won't be passionate enough to fight for it to be changed. And I think that there is a kind of, I just wanted to say that I think that's an important part in getting to the third thing that I just want to say, which is about the campaign, the Make Poverty History campaign this year. I'm sure that some of you know something about it. We are operating in 70 countries under many different names, united by the white symbol of the white band. We are doing everything we can, particularly in this country, to put so much pressure upon the government that it becomes impossible for Tony Blair to walk out of Gleneagles and say, oh, we've got a great initiative on girls' education, or we're going to give another billion to AIDS. But he has to deal with the issues of debt and trade and aid. And I would only invite all of you to do anything that you can, write anywhere that you can, talk to anyone that you can, get involved in any way that you can, because you don't know how change happens in society, but it does, I imagine, happen in a much more human and intimate way than one would possibly imagine. We were speaking to an important member of the government. I had lunch with him 3 months ago, and he couldn't have been less interested in what I was saying and more interested in the menu. And then about a week later, he texted me saying, will you get all the Make Poverty History people off my back? I'm dealing with it. And that can only have been five people. It wasn't 10,000 people outside his house. It was, you know, a person from an organization, a friend, something that he'd seen in a newspaper, something that he'd seen on television, which made him think that this was a great movement. And I think that, you know, there'll be someone in this room who can do something extraordinary which may make a difference this year. And it's an exciting year because of the fact that there is a date. In fact, there are three dates. There's a crucial UN meeting and a crucial meeting with the World Trade Organization. But for us, there's a meeting in Glen Eagles on the, I think, 7th and 8th. I hope that anyone here who can do anything in this crucial 12 weeks will do it. And I don't think there's anyone doing more about this issue than Jeff is. And I think you should talk to him and not listen to me. Thank you very much.
Underlining the point that President Bush promised in the Millennium Challenge account an increase in US aid by, I can't remember the figure, but by some quite large amount in about 2001. And as of yet, I think not one penny of that has actually come through. The promise was made, the headlines were gained, but the delivery, nothing. Is that approximately right?
Well, they finally signed a first contract for $100 million last month, and they kept saying to me, "Why are you complaining so much? You know, it's hard to set this up." I said, "You fought a whole war in between. You know, you spent $200 billion on this war. You couldn't get out more than $100 million for poor people." So they finally started last month, but they still have a long ways to go to even come close to earlier promises.
Okay, we have just under half an hour, and we have stewards with microphones. There should be many sharp questions. So the floor is open. Yes, you up in the balcony. Can you just take a microphone, and can you also say your name? Is the microphone working?
I think it is now. My name is Mark Rogers. I have a question for Professor Sykes.
Speak up.
I have a question for Professor Sykes. During your presentation, you very much talk about the people, obviously, in poverty, and you talk about us, those who are nationals of developed markets. But you don't talk about the link between them, which is the nation states themselves. And you seem to be avoiding the issue of the responsibility of a nation state towards providing for its own people. So my question is, could you perhaps tell us what is the responsibility of these states towards their own people, and whether when aid is given, whether it should be conditional or not, and on what?
Would you like to reply to that, or would you prefer to take a couple of more
questions?
Why don't
we take a couple?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
but I will take it.
Let's take two more questions. One down here. Yes. The microphone. Sorry, what's a 3x5?
That's the WHO initiative to treat 3 million people with antiretrovirals by the end of this year. None of these initiatives, Stop TB, Roll Back Malaria, and the 3x5 initiative, are anywhere near the targets that WHO themselves have set. Meanwhile, as I think Jeffrey knows, we have tools available which will at least alleviate morbidity, probably mortality, at a cost of around 20 cents per person. 20 cents per person per year of treatment, which is a spectrum of the disabling diseases, which if people survive malaria or HIV or don't get HIV/AIDS, they will still be impoverished by ear helmets, river blindness, trachoma, etc., etc. Now, we believe that is an integral part of the quick win. It was actually referred to in the Commission for Africa report. Now, the key thing here for me is the public health community has got to recognize HIV, AIDS, malaria, and TB are going to be with us forever, because you're not going to address transmission. Even impregnated pregnancies only reduce transmission by 50%, for the best case. And in terms of the targets for impregnated nets, probably about two countries are above about 10% of impregnated nets reaching vulnerable people. So one has got to accept the public health reality that these things are going to be here for a very long time.
Did you say only two countries have more than 10%?
Well, I mean, I don't know
what
the figures are, but
that's
about countries around like Sao Tome or Gambia, where the tradition of pregnancy. Most of the countries in the Rollback Malaria Initiative are below 5% in terms of vulnerable people covered with
malaria. Wow. Below 5%.
If you
multiply that by the efficacy of transmission, you're actually having no impact at all.
Did you hear that? The bed nets are having no impact at all. That is such an important set of points that I think perhaps you should reply directly.
Yeah, but it's not a critique. The point, I think. I have been saying for many years on bed nets, for example, don't sell the bed nets, give out the bed nets. Okay. DFID has been selling the bed nets in what's called social marketing.
DFID?
DFID, yes. DFID. It's really, I'll be polite here. It's really an unconsidered policy to try to sell bed nets to people that have no money. And the result has been dreadful. We should have a mass distribution of bed nets for free in a public health manner rather than a, quote, social marketing manner. I'm going to be presenting to the Secretary General, I hope for him to present to the G8 leaders for the summit, a mass distribution plan so we don't have exactly those horrendous numbers of 10%. Let me say, on both questions, though, I want to be very clear about something. I was given absolutely 100% strict limits on 30 minutes, and so I only talked for 38 minutes. There's a lot to say. The report that we issued to the Secretary General is 2,700 pages in 14 volumes, and it talks about geohelminths, trachoma, leprosy, and many other things. I agree completely. I'm too telegraphic, of course. Read the book, but you're absolutely right. The headlines are only the headlines. They're not the story, and the story has the need for basic health care on a comprehensive basis, and that's a lot of interventions, and you can do deworming geohelminth infections, and Jimmy Carter has nearly eradicated a guinea worm now in his project with many other partners, so there's wonderful things that can be done. On the question about the responsibility of nations, big responsibility, and I should be very clear about a fundamental point, which I didn't even mention, actually, and it is a fundamental point. There are places in the world where we really cannot help very much because the governance is so miserable that it is not possible to do significant help. You can do some ameliorative emergency or humanitarian help through NGOs, perhaps, but you can't do significant institutional building because the governance is miserable. I put Zimbabwe in that list right now, put North Korea in that list, and there are many, many others. My point is that in my country, those bad examples are reified as the whole story. So you have the most horrendous ignorance, of course, of geography and reality. And what is a bad example becomes the only story, and that's why corruption became the number one, the number two, the number 16 explanation of everything, and it's phony. It's mostly an excuse, it's laziness, and so on. But what is the responsibility to get precise? Ethiopia's GNP, conventionally measured, is about $150 per capita. These numbers don't take too seriously. It's all imputed income. You don't know anyway, but roughly. A country like that might be able to raise 12% or 15% of GNP in revenues if it's lucky, because most of that income is non-monetary to begin with. And so you have a tax collection ability anyway in the teens. Let's say it's 15% for purposes of discussion. 15% of 150 per capita is $22.50 per person per year in government revenues. That is for water, roads, infrastructure, public administration, court system, public health, and so on. It doesn't go very far, because poverty means that you can't provide the most basic goods out of public revenues. And no matter how you cut it, poverty, extreme poverty, is extremely depriving. And that's true of public functions as well as private functions. So there's no public health care system. In Ethiopia, public spending on health has been running at about $2 per person per year. That's not because the government doesn't care. It's because there's no money right now. And if you do education, and if you try to help farmers grow enough food and stay alive when water's short, $22.50 doesn't go very far. So what looks like bad governance often is just extreme poverty. You can't mount an effective response. So what we've done in the UN Millennium Project and in the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, which I chaired in 2000 and 2001, was to ask, what is reasonable to expect of a well-functioning, well-directed, poverty-fighting government in terms of the revenues that it can raise? What's reasonable to expect of impoverished people that are not even staying alive? They don't have enough food to eat, much less to buy discretionary goods. And therefore, what's a gap of what you would need to fight geo helmets, malaria, AIDS, treadle pumps, and other things? That's exactly how we make the calculation. If you have a rich country sloughing, the calculation tells you it doesn't need help. If you have a poor country well-directed, we find the financing gap. And when I come to say 70 cents out of $100 of aid from the rich countries to the poor, the 0.7 standard, that is what we find is needed, actually, to make good on the financing gap to enable enough investment to undertake the basic core disease fighting, hunger fighting, infrastructure developing interventions that get you out of the poverty trap. Actually, we find that it's about 0.55, not 0.7. And we say, since there's wars and tsunamis and other things, go for the 0.7. And within that envelope, most of it needs to go to the poorest of the poor. So the responsibility of governance is rule of law, transparency, readiness to be partner, seriousness about fighting poverty. And then that makes light, and I think Ethiopia fits the bill perfectly. I think Ghana fits the bill beautifully. I think Senegal fits the bill beautifully. I think Mozambique fits the bill beautifully. Tanzania, Madagascar, Malawi, many places around the world. And we're not helping those places either. And they can't do it on their own. That's the essence of the argument.
Okay.
My name is Kate Gibson. I'm from LEAD International. Just a quick question. I wanted to find out from Professor Sachs what you think it will take to ensure that the massive increase in investment called for in your work and in the Commission for Africa report are actually agreed to at Gleneagles, and more importantly, are implemented in full. And what kind of mechanism will be required to monitor delivery against these so those commitments don't go the way of the 0.7% commitments made in the past?
Let's take one more question down here. Thank you.
Just before you begin, I have an announcement. Jamie Brown in the audience please contact main reception? Jamie Brown, contact main reception. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Daisy Cooper. I work for the Commonwealth Policy Studies Unit, which is the think tank for the modern Commonwealth of 53 nations. I have two very quick questions for Professor Sachs. Firstly, you were talking about poverty traps, and you said that there wasn't a multinational company or the IMF in sight. But is the UN there, or are they also working, you know, in areas that are more accessible and easier? So really, is the UN actually reaching out to these poverty traps, or are they also restricted not to go there? And my second question is about the link between security and development. Of course, you know, your report will be going to the UN summit this September, but the high-level panel on threats, challenges and change is also going to the UN summit this September. There is a real danger that the agenda for development is going to be, you know, is going to be overshadowed by the agenda for peace and discussions about Security Council reform. There will, of course, be lots of very nice MDG-friendly speeches at the opening session of the General Assembly. But really, how are you going to ensure that people do make commitments, that when they make the commitments, that the money will actually turn up? If the money does turn up, where will the money actually go through? Will it be the IMF? Will it be Gordon Brown's IFF? Will it be the Millennium Challenge account? How is the money, what is the mechanism through which the money is going to come through the donors into developing countries?
Would you like to take those?
Sure.
MDG friendly, by the way. That's jargon for Millennium Development Goals. Sympathetic. Jeff?
Okay. So, how could we actually get from where we are to where we need to be in the next 4 months then have it work and be implemented? Those are both the questions. And what's the role of the United Nations in all of this? First, here's where we are. Well, let's start, as you do in dynamic programming, where do we need to be? We need to be at a 0.7 commitment on July 7th. Okay. So how are we going to get there? The following way. There are right now, as I said, of the 22 donor countries in the Development Assistance Committee, five that have long been there at 0.7. Seven have recently set a timetable. What the Secretary General, what our report, what the Africa Commission, and incidentally, what the high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change all said was set a timetable to reach 0.7 by 2015. That's what our report shows as a ramping up of investments so that you can make these investments and reach the goals by 2015. So it's not 0.7 today, it's 0.7 from the current 0.25 and reach that in 2015. A huge breakthrough came last week. Germany announced a timetable to 2014 to reach 0.7 by 2014. You now have, as new pledgers, Germany, France, UK, Belgium, Spain, Ireland, Finland. We're almost at a EU-wide commitment. Louis Michel, the Commissioner for Development, said yesterday that he's looking for a commitment of 0.5 by 2010 and 0.7 by 2015 for all the EU. Please make this happen next month. This is what the ECOFIN and what the Council of State of the EU in June should decide. We need Europe to be civilized, please, because it's a good example for the United States. And because it's very important on its own right. If Europe can come through to 0.7, first, it's a breakthrough of significant financing. And second, it's extremely powerful geopolitically. Why did Germany announce last week? For many reasons. A, they should. B, they noticed that it wasn't as terrible politics as they thought. And C, they want to become permanent members of the UN Security Council. And the high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change, the UN Millennium Project, and the Secretary General last month in his wonderful report all made the observation that if a country seeks global leadership, it has particular global responsibilities to honor its commitments. And I've been talking to dozens of ambassadors at the United Nations and to many world leaders, and I think that Africa is going to ask a question of any new aspirant for permanent membership: what have you done for us lately? And the way you become a permanent member is you have to get 128 votes in the General Assembly. And the African Union has 54 votes, and the G77 has a lot of votes. And I don't think they're disposed to vote for countries that are not paying attention to their commitments. And I also think that they're not disposed to vote for countries who don't understand that development is core to security. Well, I know that Germany was paying attention to those arguments, and it matters. I was in Japan last month. Japan was nervously watching Germany, because Japan also wants to be a permanent member of the Security Council. Japan has been cutting foreign assistance for years. It's down to 0.2. It's dreadful. It's shameful. This is a country that should be the second largest aid donor, and it's been cutting aid consistently. Japan doesn't stand a chance of becoming a member of the Security Council if it doesn't make a radical turnaround in aid. They know it. Last week they announced a doubling of aid for Africa. Good start, but from a base of almost zero, better do better than that. And so we're now into real counting of numbers. We're no longer into the symbols. Inside the Canadian government, there's anguish right now. I was just in Canada. I enjoyed watching the anguish, because they should be anguished. It's a little bit of a disgrace that Canada is not in this camp. Canada can call itself the home of 0.7. It was Lester Pearson's commission in 1969, Partners in Development, that set the 0.7 standard that was voted by the General Assembly in 1970. Prime Minister Paul Martin owes it to the world, to himself, his government, his country, to honor that commitment as well. And inside the government, I can tell you a number of ministers that are fighting hard for it, and I can tell you some ministers that are reluctant. And I actually think that when Tony Blair gets on the phone and calls his friends, it's going to make a difference, and he's going to be able to deliver Canada. Well, we're just down to one country then.
Let's have a couple of more questions up there in the front of the balcony.
I don't mean to be too long-winded, but I do want to say a word about implementation. Mm-hmm. What we need are national strategies designed by countries where donors pool the resources to make them achievable and financeable. Those strategies need an implementation plan. Those strategies should explain how the money can go directly to the villages for perhaps half of the total, to the districts for perhaps a quarter of the total, and to the central government for the big infrastructure projects. They should be designed with an implementation strategy. That implementation strategy should be quantitative. There should be benchmarks and numbers attached: how many bed nets, how many children, how many villages reached, how many clinics built, how many schools built. And then they should be audited. And who should do the audits? We should get, seriously, the private sector to actually do the audits and make spot checks on villages. And we should put this on a business basis, because the aid agencies are not working on a business basis now. This is not a blank check. Is it with conditions? You're damn right, it's filled to the hilt with conditions. The conditions are you do what you said you're going to do. Those are the conditions. Let the country write a plan, set quantitative targets, and then monitor it like hell, as far as I'm concerned. Because nobody in the world writes blank checks for anything. You even have prenuptial agreements, right? You don't write blank checks for billions of dollars. And you don't get squeamish about saying you have to carry out your word. That's not nasty. That's not patronizing. That's a simple business relationship. And we should do the business of honoring our commitments, and we should be held accountable for them, that the money actually flows. And we have the right to say if the money flows, the schools get built and the bed nets reach, and we're going to go out and count them. And you put this on a completely different relationship, that we know what we're doing, we know when we're supposed to do it. We're doing an investment project, basically. And we should do the milestones and the benchmarking and the audits to make it serious. And I don't know of a leader in the world, I've been advising developing country leaders for 20 years, I don't know of a leader in the world that's squeamish about conditionality when the aid is really there and when the conditions are for the fulfillment of the projects assigned. They don't care about conditionality there. What they hate is conditionality when there's no help. That's what the IMF does. All conditions, no help. If there's help, put the conditions on. That's how it works in life. You write a contract, and that's what we need.
Up in the balcony.
Hello, Tariq Ali from Imperial College London. My question is, I'm here.
Thank you.
You may know that the Department for International Development has recently appointed its first chief scientific advisor in Professor Gordon Conway.
Yeah.
So two quick questions. One would be, what do you see the priorities for directed R&D programs in meeting our goals? And secondly,
directed what?
R&D.
R&D. And secondly, what would your advice be to a new chief scientific advisor in this context?
From your presentation, it sounds like the solution's all pretty straightforward. So I have a question about a particular case where maybe the solution isn't that straightforward. You have been an advisor for many years to Bolivia, and also in your book you have a chapter about Bolivia. And Bolivia for many years has carried out economic policies, and in the last 20 years its economic indicators haven't significantly improved. So I want to ask you, what's your advice for Bolivia?
So on directed R&D, we make a number of recommendations in the report. Specifically, we actually say that R&D for science for the poor should probably rise on the order of about $7 billion a year is our estimate, because so little R&D is actually directed at problems of those who live in ecological zones different from us, those who face tropical disease, tropical agriculture conditions, tropical climates, tropical energy needs. So much of the R&D is for the circumstances in which we live and is not directly applicable. It doesn't cross the ecological boundaries. So high priorities for me, certainly agriculture. There's a lot of good biotech, by the way, that should be applied. So I want to make clear I'm a big biotech fan, particularly for looking at drought-resistant genes, which have proven in the lab enormously promising. If we could get drought-resistant seed varieties, this could be hugely beneficial. It would probably have saved a lot of lives that may now be lost, or people certainly that will suffer in Malawi, because it was a three-week drought period and it killed the corn crop. But with drought resistance, you can go through a temporary drought like that and find your way to a proper harvest. In health, there's a whole host of tropical diseases where you don't do R&D, basically, and where one doesn't do R&D. And this has been known for ages, that the vast majority of biomedical research is directed at temperate zone diseases or at diseases that are in both zones, but not strictly tropical disease. We need new drugs for these tropical diseases. We're losing one after another to resistance, or they're ineffective, they're difficult to manage, they're toxic, and so forth. So that's a second area. Third area is rural energy. Huge conundrums of effective rural energy, low-cost solar, for example. What to do about these kitchens? It's actually one of the trickiest problems on the ground in villages. Building a chimney is quite expensive, actually, and it's not a great solution to continue to use fuel wood. Do you really want to change to kerosene, to LPG? What should people cook with in Ethiopia? It's a very, very tough, unsolved problem, as far as I am concerned, having read the vast literature and seen all the options. I don't think we have a good answer for that. And finally, climate. Both handling climate variability, but adaptation. We talk about mitigation and adaptation. There's no work on adaptation that is serious in terms of what should real live people do when the Sahel is drying out. What we get is Darfur. We don't get solutions. And so we need R&D significantly for managing water change, water stress that comes from climate change, for example. For Bolivia, the book explains, in fact, it was my first little personal epiphany, the understanding of what it meant to be an Andean landlocked country in terms of the difficulties of development. And so for 20 years, I've been saying that Bolivia needed help specifically to overcome this kind of isolation, which has blocked its access, not just access, blocked its ability to become a diversified economy. It's not true, as the book shows, they made some progress, but not enough, absolutely not enough. And I saw the horrendous effects of U.S. policies again. The U.S. militarized the destruction of coca leaf, which hundreds of thousands of peasants and their dependents live off of, put the rural areas into crisis, created a political crisis where you had the mobilization of peasant coca growers, no solutions, a divided society, and no financing help. And what happened, and I've written about it at some length, when the government said to the United States, we're desperate, we're squeezed, we've followed through your recommendations of eradicating coca, and there's a regional crisis and we're trapped because we only sell basic commodities, help us, the United States laughed it off. And the result is chaos. So Bolivia is exactly the kind of place that I'm talking about. You make a diagnosis, you see that it's not the same living at 12,000 feet above sea level in the Andean highlands in a landlocked country. It's not the same as being in a port in Penang in Malaysia. And that's the point of the book, actually. Why is it that places like Bolivia have such a hard time getting out of their mess? Because they have a profoundly challenging time integrating in a normal way in a global economy. And 12,000 feet above sea level is really the core of the challenge. It's one of the cores of the challenge. The other core of the challenge is a very divided society. And that's part legacy of history, and it's part an interactive effect of the isolation as well.
Okay, since so much of Jeff's talk was about disease, I can't resist just seeing whether you from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine want to make one last remark or comment or question.
Now, I think the important thing from the point of view of people in international health is what Jeffrey and his colleagues have done in highlighting really what can be done very cheaply, very cost-effectively. And I think the health community has to be grateful that it's taken an economist to draw the attention of the policymakers to these very issues, because our voices actually don't actually matter too much, because as somebody alluded, and I think it was Jeffrey Sachs, you just start to keep knocking on the door of the politicians. And Richard Curtis has made exactly the same point. We can do these things, and they have been done. But nobody's prepared to actually implement what is implementable. I'm terribly grateful for the opportunity, but I'm sure I speak on behalf of the audience. We've really had a fantastic evening, and thank you very much indeed for... I would make one final point, and it is actually related to what Jeffrey Sachs focused on, and that's bed nets.
That's what?
Bed nets. It was 100 years ago that Ronald Ross proposed that very intervention. And where are we now?
10%.
Okay, the game plan is that Jeff will be outside signing copies, autographing copies of his book. So I just ask you to allow him to exit in order to get into the position to do the autographing.